All right, welcome golfers. Welcome to the On Par podcast. Pleased to be joined by Lawrence Donegan, the co-founder of Mikella Magazine. Lawrence, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Before we get started to the actual magazine, let's talk a little bit about some current issues that actually are sort of tied to your magazine. You did that, or I'm not sure it was you or Jeff Shackelford, but that funny piece by on the backstopping faux letter, if you will, from the PGA Tour. But you know, we've had these issues that have called into question the integrity, the decorum of the game. We started with backstopping. We've got Phil's antics at the U.S. Open. We've got now a recent allegation of a bad drop by Kang, or cheating, if you will. We've got continuous long, slow play. Just curious what your thoughts on the current state of the game when it comes to integrity and decorum.
Well, I don't think it's really changed over the years. I think there is an issue. Well, actually, no, that's wrong. I think some elements have changed. But I think in terms of the quotes and quotes cheating thing, mm-hmm. I think it's always been there. I don't think anybody who follows the game seriously or who knows anything about the game would deny that it's always been there. If you look back, it's look back through the last 50, 60 years, you know, as long as there's been media, there's always been some sort of issues. I remember, was it Tom Watson refusing to sign, was it McCumber's card? Remember Watson and Player had a big bust up.
Sure, Watson and Player, Norman and was it
Norman and McCumber?
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff goes on and has always gone on. I think, you know, if you look back in the media, I think it's Golf World UK, and in the UK, Golf World Magazine, or one of these magazines that would always do an annual survey, anonymous survey. Mm-hmm. And they would ask players, you know, have you ever seen any incident of cheating on the golf course by a fellow professional? And the answers in the affirmative were always in the 80 to 90%. So in terms of that kind of stuff, bad drops and also sorts of other shenanigans, not calling on yourself, I think it goes on. It's always gone on. But in terms of the looking at the Phil stuff, I'm trying to think of who else is coming. Yeah, I just think there's an issue with entitlement these days.
Sure.
I sense that. Look at Phil at the US Open. I mean, I know we're going over old ground here, but for me, as a perspective of a fan more than a journalist,
yeah.
I just thought, golf was here before you, and it's going to be here long after you've gone. At least show a bit of respect.
Yeah.
And you just kind of wonder where that lack of respect or that sort of self-centeredness comes from.
Sure.
And I just think that these guys, and it is partly related to money, I think. These guys are wealthier than God. And I just think inevitably it seeps through into the subconscious and they start behaving in ways that's kind of disrespectful to the game, to its traditions, to
right.
its history.
Sure.
And I think, looking at the way Mickelson behaved at the US Open, that's what I thought. And that feeds on because, take a guy like me as a fan, I'm gradually becoming more and more disillusioned with top level golf, PGA Tour golf, because I can't stand the way that some of these people are behaving. I think it's disrespectful. I think that, they're separating themselves from reality. Again, I don't want to get political, Andrew,
right.
but I will very, very briefly, this whole business with, although I do notice that it's not happened for a long time. All these PGA Tour pros were lining up to play golf with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Again, I probably lost half your listenership at this point. the one that got me was Rory, because I just love Rory. I just couldn't believe. I mean, the day that Rory played golf with Donald Trump, it came out that day that the Sessions was contemplating a militarized immigration force at the border. I mean, this
right.
kind of stuff. I mean, I know we're now far away from golf, but my point is that professional golfers at the very, very top level seem to be separating themselves from reality.
Yeah.
Or the lives of, the people that follow the game, and it just kind of bugs me. And the Mickelson thing was, to me, was very symptomatic of that trend.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And no one seems to be... doing anything about it in terms of curbing this sort of sense of entitlement. In fact, I just wonder how long sponsors I get the business model of golf in terms of sponsorships, and these guys are doing this for partly for the charitable things, partly for the, you know, they get to their clients or their administrative staff gets to play with pro golfers and whatnot. But I mean, as a product, how long can they do they want to endorse this kind of behavior, the slow play, this sort of this and deal with this sort of entitlement? I can't imagine that's not bleeding into their interactions with the people who are sponsoring these tournaments.
Well, first things first, never underestimate the desire of a corporate CEO to play golf with a PGA Tour pro. So.
I know. Right, which is another part of the problem, right? This idea of this fascination with celebrity. It has no bounds even in the golf world.
Yeah, in terms of entitlement, I forgot. It was the Jimmy Walker stuff.
Yeah, that was my fault. Yeah.
That was just extraordinary. I mean, let's put credit in inverted commas. Credit to him for actually being honest. But what it revealed.
Yeah.
You know, I will help my mates. I will help you if I like you. You know, this arbitrary, you know, Jimmy Walker scale of likability applying to golf. I mean, it was just extraordinary. It really pissed me off.
Well, the interesting thing about that, too, though, is that it is, you don't see a lot of that in major championship golf. Right.
No, you don't.
Right. So why, you know, so all of a sudden now, because it's just a regular, you know, the John Deere Classic, I'm just going to waive the rules of, you know, and have no zero integrity during the match.
Yeah, for your friends.
Not for
somebody you don't like.
Right.
I tell you what, though, the one great thing about that, the Jimmy Walker stuff, I don't think we'll be seeing very much of that, because I don't doubt. And this is, again, we're moving off topic, really, but. The lack of transparency in the PGA Tour means we don't know what they're what they're up to, what they're saying to the pros. But I pretty much guarantee that Walker, I'm not sure he would have got fined, but he would certainly had a good stiff talking to.
Yeah,
I would imagine, and I think, although I'm surprised if a missive hadn't gone out, like the comedy missive in our magazine, if a missive hadn't gone out, that hasn't leaked. But the PGA Tour is pretty good at secrecy, so I'm sure they must be doing something about it. In terms of your original question, will it bleed out into sponsorship? I doubt it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I'm a corporate sponsor, I'm looking at the broad audience. I mean, you have a narrow cross-section of the broader audience, i.e. golf geeks and golf nerds like me, who will be peed off about it. But the broader, you know, the 95% won't really care or won't really notice or won't care. And I think if I'm Mr. Corporate CEO, I will go with the broader audience. So I'm not sure it will ultimately have an effect, because if you look at the finances at the PGA Tour and the money it's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
That to me is a huge, huge snowball, and it's hard to see when it's going to hit a big rock and smash that snowball to pieces.
Yep. Do you think, while we're on the subject, I was just curious, and with Jimmy Walker and Phil Mickelson, do you think that there would be any, do you think there would be a segment of the tour that might give Jimmy Walker, even Phil Mickelson, a sort of strange eye in the locker room, or sort of give a little bit of a frosty, you know, hello, just based on their behavior?
I doubt it. Maybe Paul Goy does. I think he's a real traditionalist, isn't he? But
well, I don't know. Lee Westwood came out. He was pretty...
That's right. Actually, that's a good point, Anthony, because I was quite surprised.
Yeah. Lee Westwood, Luke Donald.
I think you call it the skank eye in baseball, don't you? I don't think they're going to be
the stink eye. The stink eye.
The stank eye, yeah. But the... But yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah.
Again, an interesting modern media development. You know, if Jimmy Walker had said that and I'd gone to, or a journalist who Lee Westwood actually likes, as opposed to me, had gone to Westwood or to Luke Donald even, both of whom had chipped in on the subject on Twitter, I'm sure neither of them would have said what they were happy to say on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which was, again, quite an interesting development. I mean, you know, if I'd gone to Luke Donald and said, what about this Jimmy Walker guy? Well, Luke Donald would, virtually certainly would have said something bland, but he certainly didn't say anything bland on Twitter. But again, these guys have got to, you know, they're in the locker, the same locker rooms every week. So I'm not sure they're going to be casting glances across the. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, again, if you hang around these guys long enough, everybody knows there's reputations and there's rumors and, you know, everybody knows what everybody else is like, you know. So
right.
I'm not sure it's going to cause any, inter-player, problems.
Right.
But, I was very interested in the fact that players spoke out on Twitter. That was good.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you said that there's no transparency, so when we have something like this, it's like a, you know, it's like a peek into the behind the scenes, really.
Actually, there's a great one going on this morning, and we were talking here this morning about Phil Kenyon and Brandel Chamblee.
Oh yeah. I caught a piece of that. I saw that Fitzpatrick had chipped in a little bit there at the end.
Yeah,
but
Westwood
got in on it too.
Oh, they've all got it. I mean, a pile of them have got in on it. It's really interesting. And the thing about
just give us a brief. It was something where Brendel Chamblee was going through the was it strokes gained putting numbers?
Yeah, but just to give you a bit of back, I mean, this is how sad I am. I know the origin story here.
We call that insight. We don't call that as that. We call it insight.
Well, Phil Kenyon, who goes under the Twitter swashbuckler, Phil Kenyon is probably the most famous putting coach on the European Tour. He coaches. I mean, he's either coached or does coach every player putting wise. He goes under the Twitter handle of Swash Putting.
Nice.
If anyone's out there wants to follow him, he's a pretty spicy guy. He doesn't. I've had my own run-ins with him. Over,
yeah. Is there anybody you haven't had a run-in with?
Oh.
Come on. No, go ahead.
I'm not a huge fan of golfers / golf coaches / people who don't / no laying up, not proper journalists.
Yeah.
Criticizing the golf media. Life is hard enough for golf journalists.
And sure,
really
sure.
Me. Anyway, so Phil had a go maybe 4 or 5 days ago at Brandel over something or other to do with stats.
Mm-hmm.
And he used a British, I think he called him a twat. Are we allowed to say that on your podcast?
Yeah, sure. We could say whatever you want. You've already talked something about Donald like Trump. If you could talk about Donald Trump, we could talk about anything.
He's funny.
I know.
He goes back to last year's putting stats for all of Phil's players. I think it's strokes gained putting. He didn't identify which exact putting stat.
Right.
And they were all pretty bad. You know, it was Justin Rose, the 121st on the PGA. It was all Rory, 174.
Right. And that's when he said that maybe, Phil, you don't like stats. That's why you don't like to look at the stats.
Actually, Phil's original point was you can take stats and if you go on that, there's some magnificent, actually, the PGA Tour website stats section is magnificent.
Yeah.
And you can go, I can go on that site and find some stats that will tell you that Rory's actually a great putter.
Right.
See, there are so many different stats created views of putting.
Right.
So Brandel, and that's why Phil got mad. Anyway, so it came back this morning, and Phil, so Phil gives it out. He's got to take it, and Brandel certainly gave it to him. But the players have piled in this morning. You said Matthew Fitzpatrick, and a few others have come in defence of Lee Westwood's another one. And Lee Westwood made a very good point that players keep going back to Phil Kenyon. So the stats might say one thing, but the money says another. I mean, if a player's willing to pay Phil Kenyon, what you find with professional golfers, they're not very keen on paying out, or a lot of them are not very keen on paying out for X, Y, or Z service,
right?
Unless really, really rate it. And
sure.
Players keep going back to Phil Kenyon, so that has to say something, doesn't it?
And is there any other, you talk about money, but is there a better stat than, earnings? I mean, obviously, these are successful golfers, and so These guys have had fairly successful careers. Does he need more evidence than that? I mean, listen, the bottom line is nobody, you know, stirs the pot better than Chambly. And sometimes I'm surprised by people who get goaded by him. But, you know, that's part of what he does. I mean, that's part of his job, so to speak. But, you know, these are fairly successful golfers. And, you know, you can talk all the stats you want, but when you look at, you know, careers and money earned, he can't be doing too bad of a job with these guys.
Well, if you look at the list of Phil's clients, they tend to be the very, very best ball strikers.
Right.
And they're at, you know, they're looking for help for a reason. I mean, take Rory. I mean, there's all this stuff about Rory's putting. But if you go back to Rory's career as an amateur, you know, the knock, there was never a knock on Rory, but the word on Rory as an amateur was, just the greatest ball striker we've seen in generations, but he's not a fantastic putter, so that might hold him back. Sure. I mean, Rory has always been a not a fantastic putter for the simple reason, and you get it. I mean, it's simple human psychology. If you're fantastic at doing something, if you're brilliant at hitting golf balls, that's all you want to do, isn't it?
Yeah, but not only that. I mean, he's always stressed the long game and the iron game since, you know, for as long as I can remember him, Nicholas telling him about that. But it's the same reason why we revel in the wizardry of Phil Mickelson, right? I mean,
that's right,
you know, it's the same thing. The guy is not go ahead. I'm sorry.
Again, the other thing is, if you're a fantastic ball striker, you're hitting more greens in regulation. If you're hitting more greens in regulation, you're taking more putts. I mean, it's just a simple fact.
Yeah.
So that's where, and Brandel knows this, but he's just been a bit naughty for the, but it's, I think it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it all adds to the colour and the gaiety of the nations. You know, do we want a sport where it's bland, bland, bland? Much, I mean, I know the PGA Tour would like that. The folks in the PR department, lovely people that they all are. But you want kind of fights, you want rivalries, you want a bit of dust kicked up, and Chambly certainly does that.
He does it as good as anybody in recent media, I would think, especially in the golf world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't think of anybody like that, certainly on TV. Oh, Johnny Miller, I guess.
Yeah, but Johnny Miller's more does it. I mean, he just does it one way. You know, Brendel's much smarter than that. He can do it in multiple ways on multiple levels.
Well, yeah. Well, Johnny's always got the. He was well.
Wow, he's just you know. It's anybody can sit there and say you choked. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. So Brandel does it in his own nuanced way sometimes.
Yeah. Anyway, it was good stuff. I urge people to go and check out if they haven't checked it out already. It's great stuff.
Well, I mean, let's. I want to transition to the. We're talking about modern media, and I want to transition to why we're here and having you on the show here as the co-founder of McCallum Magazine. I was reading the piece on Frederick Dreyer, and there's a last bit. There's a passage that part of a passage that caught me. That made me think of you when he said that he deeply regretted the commercialization and the vulgarization of the game that is taking place in the recent years, and often expressed his regret that the game was ruled by people without cultivation. And it made me think of you because it made me think of this is part of the reason why you probably started this this enterprise.
I guess.
No, you don't think so? I mean, you think that modern media has become so vulgar in its mechanics that we've lost the art of writing and long form journalism and just so it that's I feel like that parallels to your plight as and your goal with this magazine.
Yeah, you're certainly right about the lack of forums for a type of golf journalism that myself and my co-founder, he's not my co-founder, he's just the other co-founder, Tom Stein.
He's nobody else's.
Yeah, exactly.
He's yours.
Tom and I, well, we were kind of disappointed, not disappointed, but, you know, you look at the media, the golf media landscape, and there's really not many places for... I mean, there's a few places remaining, but not many places for long-form golf journalism. You know, articles that... I mean, there's always going to be a... You know, if you can get the inside griff on, you know, whatever, Tiger and Thomas Galea, for instance, the famous Dr. Galea, then any media publication, you know, would publish that. But, you know, perhaps there's not a place in the world of golf media for a piece on Frederick Dreyer. Is that right. How you pronounce his name? Yeah, who was, in case people don't know, he was, you know, Denmark's kind of quotes and quotes national golf architect.
Right.
There wasn't a place in the golf media landscape for something on, you know, Shell's, a kind of look back at Shell's wonderful world of golf, which Michael Crowley's done in our issue one, which is absolutely fantastic.
Well, it's my, we'll get to that in a second, because that was one of my favorite pieces.
So there is that, but, you know, the idea of sitting on my high horse and looking down across a media landscape and being appalled, I mean, that's what I kind of slightly step back from, Anthony.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just a lack of, you know, a lack of a forum for that kind of writing. This idea has been kicking around for a long time. Lauren Rubinstein, who's written an incredible piece on George Knudsen in issue one, he had this idea 20 years ago for a high-end, you know, not terribly commercial, you know, if we can wipe our shoes and get out the door, then we'll be quite happy.
Mm-hmm.
Forum for long-form, fine writing on golf, fine illustration, mercifully, I call it golf porn.
Mm-hmm.
Golf porn is, I mean, every golf course, you take the worst dog track in the world and take a photograph of it at dusk, it's going to look pretty sweet, isn't it?
Yeah,
because golf courses do. But there's enough of those kind of publications around, I feel. So we didn't want any of that kind of stuff. We wanted, you know, nice, beautiful illustrations, you know, very few photographs, and certainly not very few golf porn photographs, and just leave plenty of room for the writing,
mm-hmm.
For stories that might not land anywhere else in the golf media landscape, because there is nowhere else for them to land. Put it all together in an appealing package.
Well...
And get it out there.
Well, let's talk about the package, because, and by package we mean the magazine itself. I don't want anybody getting ideas. But
if you're trying to get me on pretension and on my high horse, I like to call it a journal. I don't know.
That's fine. The McKellar Journal. But let's talk about the packaging, because to me it's absolutely brilliant. I love. It is the antithesis of a glossy magazine, but it's economical in size. The writing is economical. It's very sort of it almost reminded me of like on some levels, like remember the Reader's Digest. You know what I mean? Like it was a little smaller than your normal standard magazine. The pictures and the art is very. Sort of, you know, that watercolory kind of, you know, layered kind of look to it, where it's not just sort of megapixeled out, so to speak, with, like you said, some sort of golf porn photography. It's beautiful, and it is like a little journal, and it's beautifully presented. Who was responsible for the overall style of the magazine? The art direction, if you will.
Well, the actual size of it... We wanted to create something that, you know, you put on your bookshelf.
Yeah.
A bit like, you know, your grandparents used to do with Reader's Digest.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a little bit bigger than Reader's Digest, but it's kind of a book size.
Yeah.
In the publishing business, you would say it's the kind of size of a trade. We'd call it in the UK a trade paperback.
Okay.
So somewhere between a paperback and a hardback.
Right.
So it's that kind of size. The overall feel, we had a really good – Tom's background is in – for a long time, he was the deputy editor of Travel and Leisure Golf, the sadly departed Travel and Leisure Golf magazine, which was a brilliant magazine back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
It looked really good. It's the absence in the modern media landscape of magazines like Travel and Leisure Golf pushed us towards doing something like this.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who actually, the size, Tom and I batted the size around for a long time. We were kind of going, if you go to a good... you know, bookstore, you'll find these, you know, those magazines like The Baffler,
mm-hmm.
and McSweeney's. I don't know if you know McSweeney's. These are literary magazines. I
wanted
this to be like the McSweeney's of golf.
Gotcha.
And McSweeney's was founded by the great writer David Eggers. So that we kind of tried to land in that space as a golf publication. If you go over in Europe, there's a few now. There's a great one. A friend of mine founded a magazine called Blizzard,
mm-hmm.
A guy called Jonathan Wilson, who kind of created the modern writing, or you call it soccer, I call it football.
Yeah.
That kind of deep dive football writing on tactics and, obscure football taking place in obscure places. And he founded a magazine called The Blizzard, which is brilliant. It's right. Really brilliant. And we kind of wanted, I mean, it's not an entirely original idea, but we wanted to do a golfing version of The Blizzard. We're not there yet because The Blizzard, I thoroughly recommend it for anybody who's interested in soccer. So we kind of aim for that in terms of, and again, we took our editorial cue from magazines like that, mm-hmm. Trying to lift a stone on stuff that you wouldn't actually find anywhere else. Try and revisit themes from the past, looking at good stories from the past that might not have been covered or people might even not know. So in terms of editorial content, that's where we were going. The actual design was a guy called Paul Craven. Tom knew from Travel and Leisure Golf. Paul was kind enough to, because we did lean a lot on, when you're starting a publication like this, you kind of got to, you got to beg and scrape and try and lean on people to help out.
Sure.
So Paul was kind enough to do that. I mean, he did a beautiful job. I think Tom found the font for the whole magazine, I think. So again, you'll see, there's a common theme in all of this, Anthony. I don't really seem to do very much.
I was going to ask you, do you have a role in this magazine or journal? Excuse me, a journal.
This thing doesn't exist without Tom. Trust
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah,
he's a nuts and bolts guy, a really good ideas guy. I've been around the golf writing business long enough. I know quite a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I've got quite a few ideas kicking around. Mm-hmm. So there we are. And really pleased. I mean, these things are harder than you think.
Sure.
And pretty fraught. I mean, I think Tom was ready to throw me in the, I don't know, what's the river? You throw me off a building in New York at some point.
Into the Hudson?
Into the Hudson River, yeah. Because, he's a nuts and bolts guy. He gets things done. I just sit there and go, oh, well, what about this? I just sit there and annoy.
Yeah. Well, because you make a suggestion, he realizes the 10 levels of things that get altered by one decision.
The thing is, my lack of expertise in this thing does not hinder my opinions on them. I'll tell you that.
No, you only know enough to be dangerous.
Exactly right. but I have to say, there's a few things you would think, looking at it now, and you think, oh, I would have done that differently, or we could have done this differently. But it's a pretty, we are so proud of it. It's a beautiful little product.
Has it gotten the response that you thought it would, or you hoped it would?
It really has.
Yeah.
In terms of sales, I think sales are pretty good. I think we did a print run of 2,000. We're well on the way to get rid of that, mm-hmm. Which is quite astonishing, really. Fantastic. We had no commercial report support, rather. We didn't go to Titleist and all these guys, and because that would, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe Titleist would want to give us $100,000. And not expect us to say Titleist golf balls are fantastic,
right?
But we're not in the business of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're happy to if there's a benevolent billionaire out there who wants to help us, then feel free to get in touch.
But, well, that wouldn't be me. But go ahead.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a shame.
Sorry.
Somebody told me you were worth millions and millions. We're so proud of it,
Yeah.
And we're already working on issue two. And what you find when you've got an issue out there, people kind of take you a bit more seriously.
Sure.
I mean, you call some guy randomly out of the blue, say, hey, we're doing a magazine. You're like, well, nobody does magazines in this day and age. Nobody's, nobody's crazy enough to found a high-end literary golf journal.
Right.
It's going to do that in 2018.
Right.
But lo and behold, we now have something to show people. And it's amazing that this kind of stuff feeds on itself. We're getting also, I think an issue too, not to give too much away, but we've got a piece on women's golf in India coming in.
Interesting.
Just out of the blue from somebody. Somebody's doing a piece of golf in Israel. I didn't even know there were any golf courses in Israel.
Right.
Apparently there are. So it's this kind of feeds on itself, and we're going to do another one this year, and maybe in 2019 we might get up to 3 issues in a year,
mm-hmm.
Depending on how things go commercially. But we think we're going to break even. Nobody's going to make millions and millions of dollars out of this,
sure.
But that wasn't the point in the first place.
Right.
It was really just to, as I say, to give, to provide a spot for for people who wanted to write long-form golf journalism and people who wanted to read long-form golf journalism. But we're always kind of open. I mean, this is my pitch for, we're always open to really, really good ideas.
Sure.
For instance, I'm really interested because my background is in news. There's an amazing piece in the magazine by Anthony Pioppi.
You mean journal. You said magazine. You mean journal.
Journal. That's right.
Come on.
Anthony has written a piece about the headlines, the Tillinghast papers about...
Oh, so good.
It's an amazing story.
And I know Phil Young, too. So he's a Long Island, Island guy.
Oh, my God. but we better be careful then.
Yeah.
But that is a brilliant piece of writing. It really is.
Yeah.
And a great story. A real kind of gumshoe, old school, whodunit kind of golf story. I'd love stories like that. I'd love more of them. Tony, I think there's about 3,000 words in the You Say I Do Nothing, or I Say I Do Nothing, but I think the piece ended up at 3,000 words in the journal, but it came in at 8,000 words.
Oh my God!
So that was my contribution.
That's your contribution.
I had to edit that, and anyway, but it's a great story.
Yeah,
it's probably my favorite in the magazine. I absolutely love that story.
That was one of the ones that I highlighted. The other one was Shell's Wonderful World of Golf. I still find it. Again, I understand the obstacles, but I can't believe that we don't have anything like of the sort that sort of no one's attempted to reprise that in some shape or form. I just love it. I think it's brilliant.
It's a great piece, and I think Michael, he talks to Al Barco, who was the original or one of the original producers back in the day. Actually, I was Michaela Golf podcast launches I think next week.
Hopefully,
if I can get my act together.
Uh-huh.
But I spoke to for the first show with Lauren Rubenstein on George Knudsen.
Yeah,
and I for my research for that interview, there's a Knudsen Shell's Wonderful World of Golf on YouTube.
Oh, is it really?
God, it's fantastic.
Oh, I'm gonna have to go check that out then.
It's Knudsen against Al Geiberger at the Victoria Golf Club in Vancouver, or British Columbia.
Yeah,
I swear to God.
Oh, that's amazing.
Of course, looks brilliant. Knudsen looks so cool. What an interesting guy he was.
Yeah. It was just interesting the way they produced those. I mean, sometimes often having to make guys take, two or three swings or shots off the first because they didn't get it, or, it was just the mechanics of it were so primitive.
Yeah.
But it was just fantastic.
It's a really good, and of course the famous ones are, I think is it Gene Littler against Pine Valley?
Pine Valley, yeah, sure.
My favorite one, although it's from a later state, it's Monty against Mickelson at
Is that in Colorado? Was that the one?
Colorado.
Yeah.
Honestly, the bit where the golf actually is not great. Monty is terrible. But when Monty goes into there's a phone booth on the ninth tee. You know when you call it?
Yeah.
Monty goes, they're filming this, and Monty goes into the phone booth on the ninth tee and tries to order fish and chips.
The only thing that would have been better than that if he had ordered a new swing, that would have been funnier, because
the idea, who eats fish and chips?
Fish and chips, Colorado.
You got to use both hands to eat fish and chips. But it's a fantastic show.
Yeah.
I know you're dead right. There's another great thing on YouTube is back in the day, it's Trevino against Ballesteros playing, I think it's a 5 or 6 hole challenge on the old course.
Yeah.
Like a one club challenge.
Sure. Yeah. I did a show with, I don't know if you probably have, but John Cavalier, the Lynx Gem guy, he's talking about the golf point. He puts out all those wonderful pictures of golf courses. We were talking about the National Golf Links of America. And I was like, that would be, if you were going to reprise like Shell's, I would have like a 6 club challenge between two pros, just 6 clubs on the National Golf Links of America. I can't imagine any body who is passionate about golf who wouldn't tune into that.
Yeah. Although maybe they did try it. I just finished that Tiger biography, the Battle of Bighorn and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit of that. But I think Tiger was miffed that Sergio was holding a 10-footer on the last and was punching the air at some Monday night made-for-TV nonsense and said, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, yeah. But so, are you a little surprised that no one's tried any kind of version of this in the modern day?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you can't. You know, Tiger and Phil aren't getting out of bed for less than or millions. So I would imagine that's out. But I mean, I don't know. I think you make it more about the golf courses. More about the golf courses rather than the players.
Exactly.
There seems to be a burgeoning interest in college golf. I mean, these and the lines between college golf and professional golf these days are getting more and more blurred in terms of talent.
Well, I like to think of those guys as professional amateurs. I mean, they're just they get put in the 0.1% that the pros get put in on some level, because the distinction between them and regular golfers is so, you know, you can't even, they're not even the same people.
I'd say another piece in the mag, our good friend Jeff Shackelford wrote a piece. Him and Gil Hans did work together on the restoration of LA Country Club.
Yeah.
Jeff did a on that, and just a kind of look on the based around the Walker Cup last year.
Yeah.
And Jeff did a piece on the kind of state of current golf architecture. Really, I mean, Jeff's, I'm trying to think what the word is. Well, Jeff's chops on this, as you would say, are pretty well established. It's a really good piece. But I went to I took my son. We went down to the Walker Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, the standard is astonishing, you know, amongst these amateurs, the top amateurs these days. Although, strangely, Sam Burns, the kid from LSU, wasn't picked for that Walker Cup team.
I know.
Turned pro and is now absolutely tearing it up on the web.com. I think he's won there this year. I think he did pretty well. He's had a couple of appearances on the PGA Tour. He is going to be some player. But you look at that team, that US team, especially from last year, Cameron Champ, Maverick McNealy. When these guys are turned pro and are doing, you know, pretty well. I don't know if Wyndham Clark played on that team. I can't remember.
No, I don't think he did. No.
But these guys have turned pro and they're you know, they're not straight on the PGA Tour. But, well, you can't do that these days unless you do something big in your seven sponsors exemptions.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. But again, to get back to the point, why don't they make it? They should do a show and make it about the golf courses.
Yeah.
I mean, who would not want to see something at Pine Valley?
Yeah.
Because we're never going to get to see that place.
Mm-hmm.
I know we saw the National Golf Links for the Walker Cup, but my goodness, I'd like a second look.
Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of modern courses that are sort of, you know, as you said, there is a burgeoning affection for old school strategy golf courses, and there's a bunch of modern courses that would fit the bill as well.
Yeah, let's take them down to Sweeten's Cove.
Right.
I know it's a nine holer, but go around twice.
That's it. That's it.
I'm dying to see. I was down, and we were down, and just didn't make it. I wasn't organized enough. But you know, places that you know people wouldn't see. Again, this is why we're not running the Golf Channel, Anthony, because we'd be out of business in a week.
Yes, exactly.
Doing programming that people actually want to see. Yeah, mind you, saying that, I think it would be expensive, wouldn't it? A lot of cameras. Anyway, and you're not selling Sam Burns against Maverick McNealy to a Japanese audience, are you? I mean, you're gonna.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Maybe a programming idea isn't so good after all.
Well, I don't know. I can't imagine that somebody is. You know, you said mentioned some benevolent billionaire that doesn't love golf or something. I think there would be a market for it. I know it would be. I get, like you said, I understand the obstacles, the financial obstacles, and you know, and these, a lot of these big golfers and their schedules and their you know, they're very and their entitlements or whatever you may want to call them. But I just think that I do believe that there would be a market for it. I do believe that there's a golf course that people would want to see. I mean, there's so many good ones. I mean, even if they were. I mean, maybe not, like the new course at Mammoth Dunes, right? I mean, that place is massive in scale. Stream Song Black, you know, another massive in scale property. I don't know. I just think that people would want to see these things.
Actually, the one I would, and again, I mean, as he deftly goes back to promoting his own journal, Tom's written a piece about Sheep Ranch.
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask you that. That was part of my piece on my connection to timely issues of the magazine, because I heard Machinella talking a little bit about something that might be getting developed.
That's right. I think Sheep Ranch, to explain what it is. Actually, Tom and I went up and played it with a couple of friends.
Uh-huh.
It's a golf. I don't know if it's a golf course. It's a golf property just north. It's the next parcel of land up from Bandon Dunes.
Yeah.
I don't know the actual. Tom knows more than me, but Tom Doak did this great. I think it's 13 greens and no tees. I think. Or you can just tee up wherever you want.
And just letters on a scorecard.
There you go, and you kind of bowl up, and you pay your $100, I think it was, we paid.
Yeah.
And you can just play golf all day and make up your own golf course. It's just magical.
Yeah.
It's just a magical place.
I love how in the piece they describe it as people used to talk about it like it was Area 51.
That's right. Yeah.
it was brilliant. That's brilliant.
Actually, I'm giving away editorial ideas. And there is a great, I thoroughly recommend this for people to go on Instagram and find an account called Golf Gates.
Uh-huh.
I love it. And it's golf course entrances.
Uh-huh.
And it's brilliant. So you have the grandiose, but then you go to a place like Sheep Ranch. I mean, you would drive past it. I mean, it's an iron gate with no sign on it.
Right.
So you really, you wouldn't find it.
Right.
Unless you know what you're looking for.
Yeah,
it doesn't come up on Google Maps, I don't think. Or if it does, I think it comes up a mile short on Google Maps.
That's fantastic.
So so that's a great account. But it's a magical place. A really, God. It reminds me of actually a good pals of mine. They run a resort in Donegal, Rossa Penna.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sure.
Frank and John Casey, and they bought property next to their place, which was it was done by Eddie Hackett. Mm-hmm. Before I think it was his last design before he died, and it fell into disrepair. And then Jack Nicklaus was brought in. He was going to do it. And, of course, Nicklaus never did anything. But Frank and John got the place. And Tom Doak is doing it for them. But it reminded me, I played the Hackett place just before it fell into disrepair. And that was very similar. You didn't know, you couldn't find it. You didn't know where it was.
Sure.
You kind of had to search it. It's part of the experience, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's like those bars in New York City where there's no entrance. And you have half the experience is you're the only one who knows where it is, or the few that do know where it is.
Or even if you don't know where it is, you're kind of driving around and you catch glimpses of it, but there's no way to get in. anyway, Sheep Ranch is like that. But I think Kaiser bought it, and he's brought in Coeur and Crenshaw. I mean, who can complain about that? But yeah. Tom makes an argument in his piece. You know, that it is a thing of its time, of itself, of its, you know, it's going to be a shame to lose the Doak, the Doak creation, because that, you know, who would want to bulldoze a Tom Doak layout, you know, especially one that was so lovingly done. The green complexes are wonderful, placements are wonderful. I mean, it's just a great place. I'm sure Coeur and Crenshaw will do a great job, but it's still sad that the original concept will no longer be there.
It's funny. It's like that property. It makes me think that it's like the speakeasy of golf, you know, in that corner of the world, right? Somewhere hard to find. It's like a guilty, like a, you know, you're there to enjoy something that doesn't seem to exist in other places, because we don't enjoy golf that way anymore.
We don't, and it's a real shame. You have that idea of you walk up and you tap on the door and the little thing slides open and you've got to give the password.
Exactly.
No, that's the wrong password. Sorry, you can't get in. anyway, the entrance to Sheep Rat is, I mean, unprepossessing doesn't even come close. Actually, reminds me of, I think it's Austin Golf Club. It's pretty similar. You're driving.
I'm not familiar.
Crenshaw. Crenshaw built it. Well, Crenshaw's a member there.
Yeah.
He built it for himself, I think. Or, well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
For himself,
yeah.
You know what
I
mean?
Yeah.
And you kind of drive out of Austin, and you get, you know, just, it's this magnificent layout on the outskirts of Austin, and you don't know, you know, it's just an iron door or an iron gate. At the entrance. So that was an idea for issue two. I know we're not really into photographs, but I really like golf course entrances.
Yeah.
I love the contrast, the way they contrast. I just think it's quite appealing. I'm sure somebody will steal it. Actually, I should give a word out for a couple of publications operating in a similar field to us. I mean, Golfers Journal, it's a bit more glossy and a bit more corporate than what we're doing, and they're kind of into golf porn quite a bit.
Yeah, sure. But well, it's a different, part of that is it's a different set of creators. I mean, it's a little bit of a younger group, and it's not to say that there isn't room for all of you. I mean, with Caddy Magazine too.
Caddy Magazine, I really do like.
I haven't gotten my hands on one yet. I will, but I'll have to check it out.
Anthony, you got to be in. You're not in the East, but you don't know the password.
What? I only plan on being purchaser 001 of only one journal.
There you go.
One journal. No, but I do want to get my hands on Caddy. I do. I'd like to see what we're doing. But my point being that, I think there's room for all three of you, and I think there are always going to be, there's going to be different editorial styles based on the fact of who's publishing these things. And you guys are a different group of a different generation of guys who. Not to say that the Golf Journal doesn't value, brilliant and intelligent long form writing. Obviously, they do, but there's a different approach.
But as I say, I just wanted to give a shout out to these. Cause, I mean, it's great. I mean, it is great because if you look at the, when I first hit the golf beat, I mean, I was first in golf journalism back in the late 90s, but I was a full time golf correspondent for The Guardian 2005 for 6 years or whatever, 7 years. And even in that time, in the space of 10 years, you go into any media tent, any golf tournament, and it's essentially deserted. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of, it's about half a dozen guys clinging to the lifeboat as it sails across the ocean of professional golf. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is, especially now, and this is not to denigrate, the social media teams of the PGA Tour, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fine as far as it goes. I'm sure there's an audience for it. Clearly there's an audience for it. PGAtour.com is really good. There's some great writers there. But you're not going to get anything about backstopping on PGAtour.com.
Right.
You're not going to get anything about this cheating scandal on PGAtour.com, I wouldn't imagine.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. That's a real shame. That kind of stuff isn't being covered anymore. I mean, look at Masters.com. Isn't that a fantastic resource? I mean, you can drive around watching the Masters on your phone, but you're never going to get anything critical on Masters.com. So there is a point, that makes me very sad.
Yeah.
Because what's going to be in 3 or 4 years' time, maybe 5 years' time, whatever, you're going to have PGAtour.com and Golf Channel, and that's going to be, and Doug Ferguson from the AP, the great Doug Ferguson. But that's going to be it.
Right. Everything is going to be on brand.
Everything's going to be on brand, as it probably should be. Mm-hmm. Well, the Golf Channel has actually been surprisingly prepared to get in and mix it a little bit.
Well,
overall,
part of it is, I'm sorry to interject, but I think part of the reason is because what's going on that we open the show with has become so overt that they can't ignore it. And you have people like Brandel Chambly who won't ignore it. But like you said, you go back to the anonymous, you go back 30, 40 years where everything, or 20 years, where everything was, you said these anonymous things where the cheating was, 90% of people seen people cheating. But, the people didn't talk outwardly about it. And now we have things overtly happening in front of our eyes, like Phil Mickelson. And so they can't, I'm not trying to take away your point about Golf Channel being willing to get in the mix, but given the level of egregiousness, if you will, it's hard not to get in the mix.
Yeah, well, that's true, but again, they have a choice. They have an editorial choice, and I think they should be given a little bit of credit.
Yeah, no, I wasn't trying to take it. Yeah,
yeah, they don't do it enough.
Yeah,
I get that because I don't know how long their contract is up. Their contract goes with the PGA Tour, but. If they're causing trouble on a daily basis for the PGA Tour, how inclined do you think the PGA Tour is going to be to renew that contract?
Right.
Yeah, especially now with the whole kind of streaming thing, the PGA Tour can, they can go to Amazon or whatever, or they can go to Netflix. So that's
or ESPN. The ESPN has their separate app now. I mean, they can go back.
I don't think ESPN's paying the billions it would cost for the PGA Tour for ESPN Plus.
Right.
But the uh, But my larger point is that the golf media landscape has essentially been devastated over the last 10, 15 years. And what's left is the kind of corporate controlled stuff, which is good as far as it goes, but it's not going to give you a rounded, you know, critical picture of the professional golf landscape. So who's going to do that? That's my that's my concern.
I think hopefully guys like you will be doing that to some on some level.
Yeah, guys like us,
provided there's a forum.
Yeah, the other thing I want to say about the magazine/journal is that we decided, very consciously not to put anything online, really, other than a link to subscribe to the magazine and maybe a description of the magazine. We wanted to, we wanted to be a strictly analog, publication.
Right.
Again, we thought it fitted in with our kind of editorial ethos of the kind of heft of our writing. We wanted the Mackellar to be a kind of a tactile thing. Again, it's probably something to do with the age that we are, not that we're ancient, but so that was, again, something that we hit because of the whole kind of digital media thing.
Sure.
You can't compete against masters.com.
Right.
I mean, I have been doing a digital media startup for the last 5-6 years. And it's virtually impossible.
Yeah,
the business model doesn't work. It really doesn't work. And if you look at BuzzFeed, heavily funded digital media corporations are really, really struggling. And so we made that tactical. We made that instinctive decision that we wanted to be an analog publication, and we'll go forth from then. If you actually look at, again, the developments in consumption, there is a slight return to analog.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a 12-year-old kid, and he buys vinyl records.
That's awesome.
I'm not saying that the vinyl records are going to put Spotify out of business, but we figured that the same is true in golf, that there's going to be enough of a niche market who would appreciate having something and holding it, taking it on the train or taking it on the bus and reading it that way, and coming back to it again and again. You know, if you have great stories, they work, like great books, they bear rereading, a couple of years down the line. And again, for the size of ours, it's something you can put Mackellar on your bookshelf. And hopefully when you look in, 5, 6, 7, 8 years' time, there'll be that little section on your bookshelves where it's all Mackellar's, and they'll have all the spines will be there, and it'll look pretty cool, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I've got number one, so we'll just say I'm on my way. It's something that struck me when you were talking about vinyl records and your son, and that sort of return to kids bringing that, and there is a niche for that in this day and age. There are lots of people now who are building. I know some of the more wealthy people are building now vinyl studios in their houses. Guys like Jimmy Fallon and a couple of others have talked about this. But just the kids, and I have a friend who has who buys vinyl records as well, and this sort of old original technology, and it reminded me of the piece on Ichikawa steel, right?
Yeah.
The idea of that, those blades, right? I love this piece just partly because of obviously because of the way it was written, but when you can work in Shintoism and Japanese feudalism and samurai, it all comes together beautifully in this piece.
The artisanal.
Yeah.
Artisanal? Yeah, there
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So think of us.
Look at
as
you being artisanal. A wordsmith.
I just really do feel that. I think there's been a couple of books. I haven't read it, but somebody was telling me about it. You know, I was punting this line of mine, and he said, there's somebody's actually written a book about the whole kind of return to analog.
Yeah, yeah.
And hopefully we can get ourselves a little piece of that. And I think the fact that, you've got Golfers Journal and you've got Caddy Magazine, we're all, the way when I was pitching this around, there is you're talking about Ichikawa steal the piece, but there's, look at Jones golf bags.
Yeah,
Seamus golf head covers.
Yeah.
There is you look at the, you're talking earlier on about, old, look at Sweetens Cove, for instance.
Yeah.
Old school type golf course designs.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an appetite. I mean, you look at the Kaiser
model.
Kaiser brand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fantastic, you know. Sure. I mean, there's a great golf course. He's very simply done. Well, not simply, but you know what I mean? If you go to Bandon Dunes, for instance, it's a very plain but classic kind of experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that, you know, we're hoping that we fit into that space.
Yeah.
You know, where Jones golf bags. I was going to say Mackenzie Walker golf bags.
Yeah, yeah, that's another one. Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure, you know, we can afford $1,500.
No.
For golf.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, Bango's another corporate sponsor. I'm sorry. Sorry, Tom.
It is a nice bag, though. I literally was talking about that with another writer. Where I was like, "Oh, yeah, I love those bags. They're beautiful." I said, "But I can't afford a $450 golf bag."
I've got the waterproof one. I've got a smaller. It's the same size, but you know, it's not the. The leather ones go. They run at about $1,500, I think.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I stop at $450, and
here we go. I'm fighting back for the Mackenzie sponsorship. I think it's called the Ballistic.
Oh yeah, the nylon Ballistic or whatever it is. Yeah,
which is gorgeous. I've got one of those. I think they run at about $250.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So. All right. That seems more affordable then.
There you go. So, yeah, but again, there's that whole world, isn't there?
Provided my wife doesn't know about it. But that's
fine. There you go. That's very familiar.
That's what I mean by affordable. By affordable, I mean my wife has no clue.
But there is that, isn't there? There's that type of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serious player.
Yes.
I mean, that sounds pompous, doesn't it? But
but you know what, though? But there's also, you say the serious player, but it's also for the player who doesn't know any better that also just wants to go play golf, because these guys are designing golf courses for the majority of people. You can't design, you know, you can't design what C.B. McDonald or Seth Rayner would design for the 0.01% of golfer. I mean, it would be an 8,500-yard golf course. It doesn't make any sense to do that. And so they're sort of bringing it back for the everyday golfer that everyone can enjoy.
Yeah, I, again, you're absolutely right. My favorite golf course in California here is Rustic Canyon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Shackelford's.
And Gill.
And Gill, yeah.
I swear to goodness, I think it's $57, and you go there and you play and it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's something new. It makes you think. Again, I'm describing McKellar here. You know, it's fun. It makes you think. It teaches you things that you didn't even think you might know. It's and you get to the end and you just think, God, that was really satisfying.
Yeah.
So there's that whole movement, you know, and again, Kaiser, you know, the whole band and that kind of crowd, that they're at the high end of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if that's a movement, then I'm kind of quite happy to be part of that movement. It's I'm happy if McKellar's part of that movement.
Well, you know, you were joking about the Mackenzie Walker as a sponsorship. I do think that, you know, it would be an idea to, if you had a consortium of those sort of those people who have the same principles as you, like a Mackenzie or a Seamus, and that wanted to come in on, you know, on what you're doing, because it doesn't really, they don't really, wouldn't interfere with any of your editorial ideas.
You're absolutely right. But what, when you get into that world, what you find is that the world of artisanal golf is pretty small, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, and everybody's scrapping away.
Right.
I mean, if you go, I went to the PGA show this year, and it really is quite astonishing. You know, the behemoths, that, you know, the Callaway. I don't know if you've ever been to Anthony. It's astonishing.
I haven't been to the no.
Oh,
no.
The Callaways and the Titleists are vast corporate. Mm-hmm. You think golf is dying? If you think golf is dying, go to the PGA show. That'll soon put an end to that thought.
Right.
They're astonishing. You know, you just realize what you're up against. Actually, there was a kind of interesting contrast. I went to the PGA show, and so on one hand, you have the massive Callaway stand. It really is. It's like something. It's huge. It's like it's an ocean-going liner, essentially. And then, you know, 100 yards away, there was a really cool little clothing company called Swanky. From Minneapolis, I think mm-hmm. they were, you know, and it was just a couple of kids, you know, making really cool T-shirts.
Right.
You know, so, you know, we're probably the couple of kids making really cool T-shirts and, you know, clinging on. And that's where the kind of artisanal you know, end of things are operating. You know, they're doing okay within their niche, but you can't, you know, it's a limited market, isn't
right.
it?
Right, sure.
I mean, but if you're happy appealing to that, then that's fine. We are. We're in there and we're happy.
Right.
But if you have hopes of breaking out and becoming the next, you know, tight list or whatever, then good
well, you're not.
That.
But you're also not looking to get some sort of. You're building something that you, where the end goal is not to get some cash infusion from a venture capitalist. You're and strike it rich. You're doing something for the good of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, that's right. Although I wouldn't, as I say, I wouldn't mind if some benevolent billionaire came along.
Well, it would make a few things easier for sure.
We'll get somebody to make Tom's cappuccinos. We'll get somebody in the office to make Tom's cappuccino. Actually, we could get an office. There you go.
Actually,
you don't need an office. In this state. You don't. No. Here's a tip for anybody who's interested in putting together a magazine. You don't need an office.
No, you don't need an office for a lot of things. We're getting. We're getting down to the wire here, but I wanted to. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, well, before we get to what I wanted to ask you, just the last bit on the PGA Show and you talking about, if you wanted to see if golf is dying, just go to the PGA Merchandise Show. But I also would like to see a study on how many return vendors there are over the course of 5 or 10 years.
Well, that's a pretty good point.
You know, you say it's not dying, but that's just because someone's come up with another gimmick to bring to the forefront that probably won't be there the following year.
But there's something, there's a beauty in that as well, though, Anthony.
Yeah.
You kind of spend, you've got the corporate side, I think, but then you get, you know, there's the mom and pop operations down the other end of the show. And,
yeah.
You know, and there's some awful things. You think some guy's been working in his garage on, you know, in his woodwork shop for a while, and he comes into the PGA Show and he's paying whatever is $3,000 for a stall, and you look at this thing he's come up with, and it's
because he thought it was a good idea that you should be able to practice your putting from the toilet.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, so, but guess what? You know, he might not be back next year, but his equivalent will be back with something different.
Yeah, that's it.
So, you make a good point, but you know, there is. There's swirl in that end of things, isn't it? There's always somebody else with it.
Well, you know, it's the reason why everybody plays the lottery, right? I mean,
well, that's right.
So,
but I don't think it's as open to the general public. Oh, I'm sure.
No, it's not, no. You know what? I think I want to say no, unless there is a very short but limited time for people not in the industry, but maybe are a member of a club or something. It might be some sort of level of public access for a very short period of time.
I think if a person wanted to go to the PGA Show, I think they would probably find a way to do it.
Exactly.
But it's certainly well worth a visit. I think it's quite fascinating.
Back to Michaela Journal. It's a journal, people. What was, other than actually getting it published, what was the most satisfying aspect of putting this thing together?
I hate to kind of, you know, it's like trying to choose between your children.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, when Lauren Rubenstein, I'm sure a lot of your listeners do.
Yeah, oh, they know. They're a smart
they
bunch.
Know who Lauren is. Lauren
my
is,
listeners are single-digit handicaps, don't worry.
Right, so Lauren is... Well, he wrote a great book on Mo Norman.
Yeah.
He wrote the book with Tiger, which is a really that kind of book, for a mainstream book, that kind of went under the radar, the Tiger Masters book. I thought it was really, really good. So I recommend that. So, you know, would Lauren's, hey, Lauren, would you please write a piece for us? Yeah, no problem. What do you want? Whatever you'd like to do. I'll write a piece about George Knudsen. So there you go. And then a month later, this thing arrives, this email arrives, and there it is. And you kind of open it up and you read it and you just go, oh my God, this is why Michaela exists.
Right, right.
And that to me, you know, I'm calling Tom and saying, God, have you read this? This is so exciting, because then you realize that, my God, this is actually going to happen. You know, there is a place for this. And that for me was a real moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was a magical moment. It's a great piece, actually. So probably that. I'm looking through here. I'm just flicking through here. There's a couple of other things as well. It was a great, again, just we are kind of open to contributions. You know,
I was going to say that because it, you don't have to be the Lauren Robinsons of the girl golf media to sort of make a contribution. Well, I mean, I know you're not. It's not like an open email, and you just, you know. But I mean, I think there is room for others.
Yeah, I was going to say because we got contacted by a guy called Stan Lapidus,
mm-hmm.
who is just,
that sounds familiar. He's actually, I think he's an
acquaintance of Lauren's who contacted out of the blue. I don't know what he does for a living or what he did for a living, but he wasn't a golf photographer. But he got somehow wangled a press pass to the 1985 Masters, the 1985 Open Championship,
mm-hmm.
the one that Sandy Lyle won, and took a bunch of photographs. And he sent us the photographs, and there was something about the photographs that were just magical. So we just decided to, you know, it's a bunch of photographs of players mid swing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that was just somebody randomly out of the blue, came up with that. So you know, that was really cool as well.
Yeah, I do.
So the Lauren thing was a big thing for me. I'm actually looking for something else here. Yeah, the other magical moment, you know, Tom had written a piece on Sheep Ranch, and we had it. It was laid out, and you know, the photographs were great. But Tom had this idea of actually getting somebody to paint them, paint mm-hmm. the photographs essentially.
Right.
And Quinn Thompson did it. I think he works for Coeur Crenshaw.
Okay.
A course shaper, and we used one of his paintings on the cover of the magazine.
Yeah, beautiful.
I mean, I saw that. That was just kind of wow. So those two individual moments for me were mm-hmm. kind of, God, we had this concept and we're actually, kind of getting somewhere close to the concept that we came up with in the first place. So those are real big moments for me.
Who came up with the cock of the green and the idea of Michaela?
We went through so many different names. That's Tom's idea.
Tom's? I love it. And that introduction is fantastic.
Yeah, Tom wrote that as well. He's a fantastic writer, much better than me, that's for sure. McKellar, and we got the name because we batted around. The magazine was going to be called Squirrel for a long time.
That is classic.
You know what? We had such a problem because, the obvious one was called for Squirrel, but, you know, that's gone. And There was something else. There was another one that was owned by The Marker. It was going to be called The Marker for a while.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out there's a magazine on genetics in Philadelphia called The Marker. And then it was Squirrel. And that just came out of total frustration. And we liked it. We thought it was kind of odd.
Yeah.
And eclectic, you know. I'd come up with this backstory for the name. You know,
well, I'll give this to you free of charge. But I bet if you started, if you put this on a T-shirt with Cock of the Green on it, I think it would sell. I think it would. That would be a great.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I'm not. I don't have my finger on the pulse of young generational spending habits. But I think it would be a fantastic shirt. I do. Cock of the Green.
Alexander McKellar, we kind of see him as the original golf nerd. He was a guy, and he was always to be found on the golf links. You know, he was supposed to be running a pub in Edinburgh, but he was never there. He was always playing golf. But the story's there, and he looks amazing. Really, really cool looking guy, and that was his nickname, the Cock of the Green.
Oh, it's fantastic! I'm actually gonna play. I'm gonna play around with some things in my spare time just to see what kind of design I can come up for something. Because I think that's, I think it sets up well for that kind of merchandising.
Yeah, it's really we're doing a little Kickstarter for issue two just to kind of help us along,
mm-hmm.
and I got a bunch of T-shirts made. So
there you go.
Very limited edition, so we'll be selling those on our Kickstarter for $300.
what kind of shirt?
It's just a shirt with a logo. It's the cock.
Got it.
The cock. Our corporate logo, our corporate branding is a cock holding a lantern. So I think that was Tom and Paul Craven come up with that. It's really cool, actually.
Again,
these are the things that you spend hours on, and you argue over, and it's the kind of nonsense stuff. What you discover when you're putting together a publication. It's not the kind of big picture stuff.
No,
that kind of takes care of itself once you conceive the idea and you've got the support. but it's the small stuff. You start arguing over fonts or, you know, or fretting over logos and, oh my goodness.
Well, I'm glad Squirrel lost, and I'm glad I'm glad Marker was taken.
That's all. Yeah, well, Squirrel was, squirrels are very eclectic. They gather stuff.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
We're
yeah.
eclectic and gathering stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, it still doesn't work. I don't care how you justify it.
So there you go.
No, it's fantastic. Well, Lawrence, thank you. Where can they get McKellar Journal?
We can get... right, let's forget this distinction. It's actually McKellarMagazine.com.
Oh,
get McKellar Journal.
All right. I don't know.
McKellarMagazine.com. You go there and you go to the shop link, or you can just go McKellarMagazine.com/shop, and you go there and you can subscribe or order a copy of issue one there. We don't actually have a subscribe function yet. Mm-hmm. We figured that we should really get, start churning them out before we ask people to subscribe for the year.
Sure.
So if you can go there, we'd greatly appreciate it. And hopefully the support are really, we're not begging. We're kind of very proud of the product that we've produced. I think you'll really, really enjoy it. I think readers would really, really enjoy it. And it's 90 pages of absolute editorial, untarnished by any sponsorship or advertising. It's all there. We think it's beautiful, and we think that people, once they get their hands on it, they'll think it's beautiful too.
Yep, I think they will. I'm proud to be subscriber 001. I just loved it. I loved it right from the minute I looked at it. Not to be dramatic, I want to say love at first sight, but it just sort of spoke when I looked at it, and I knew it was going to be a little different. Once I didn't see it, it was like, not a knock on anything else, but I just love the fact that right off the bat, it says I'm not a high gloss supermodel, but it will be just as entertaining and intelligent and thought provoking as anything else. And it is, like I said, you can get everything from Shell's Wonderful World of Golf to Japanese feudalism, to Tree Trouble, to George Knutson's of the PGA Tour. So it's got something for everybody, and I think if you love golf, you'll love reading it. So I highly recommend it. It's beautiful in its presentation and in its content. So Lawrence Donegan, thank you very much for joining me today. The pleasure was all mine, my friend.
Thanks, Anthony. Talk to you soon.
All right, that was Lawrence Donegan, McKellar Magazine. You can get it at McKellarMagazine.com. And so that concludes this week's podcast. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.